Early in his career as a deliverer for God's people, Moses faced some discouragement. It was this man who went to the land of Egypt. He spoke to Pharaoh, he spoke to the king of Egypt, and he said, "Let Israel go." You may remember that Pharaoh said no, as we learned from Exodus chapter 5. Not only did Pharaoh say no, Pharaoh imposed some extra work on the Hebrew people, and that did not go over very well with them. In Exodus 6, we find that Moses came to the Hebrews with some additional news. The time is coming, the time is here for God to deliver you. It's going to get better very, very soon. As we looked at last week, though, God's people, because of the discouragement, because of the extra work, they didn't want to hear that word from Moses. They basically closed their ears, even though Moses tried to give them a very comforting, a very blessed message. After Israel said that they didn't want to hear any more from Moses, God delivered another message. Heaven, and we start tonight with Exodus chapter 6, verses 10 and 11. Heaven said to Moses, "You need to go again. You need to go once again to Pharaoh and communicate to this ruler that it is time to let God's people go." Verse 10 says, "And Jehovah spake unto Moses, saying, Go in, speak unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and that he let the children of Israel go out of his land." Now, as you think about what Moses must have been going through at this time in his life, it's probably fairly easy to get some sense of what he was experiencing. Moses, at this time, had reached the age of 80 years old. God had called him to be obedient to his will, to go and serve as a deliverer, and Moses had been obedient. He left the area where he was, he goes to Egypt, he talks to Pharaoh, he's been trying to do what God told him to do. But as Moses perhaps thought about how things were going, it must have appeared to him that things were not going very well. Yes, he'd come to Egypt, but Israel was still in bondage. They hadn't been delivered. Not only was Israel still in bondage, now the Hebrew people have additional work piled on them, and things actually seem to be worse. Had we been Moses, we might have been thinking, if God wants me to go see this ruler again, will that really make things any different? What could another visit to this ruler possibly do? Maybe it's going to make things worse. If the king did not listen before, why on earth would he now listen this time? Moses seems to have had some of these very thoughts, because as we look at verse 12, the very next verse, here's what he said. "And Moses spake before Jehovah, saying, Behold, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. How then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips?" Now in this verse, we find three different statements. First of all, Moses reminded God, like God needed reminding. But first of all, Moses reminded God that Israel had not listened to him. "You have appointed me as a spokesman for this nation to get them out of captivity, and yet the people will not hear what I have to say." And then Moses comes right out and asks God, "How will the ruler of Egypt listen to me?" And then Moses makes this third statement, which is unusual. It's not a statement that we find too often in the Bible. Moses said he had uncircumcised lips. We, as we look at the Bible, need to, at various times, interpret a passage as far as whether it is literal or whether it is figurative, and such is also true here. As we look at the Hebrew people, they did not literally circumcise, they did not literally cut off some part of the lips. But this is a figurative expression that, as far as I can tell, conveys a couple of points. First of all, there seems to be the idea of moral uncleanness. Now, if this is part of what Moses was saying, I don't know what he may have been thinking as far as, maybe as he looked at his life, some moral uncleanness. Second, this expression seems to contain the idea that Moses felt incapable. And we can, as we think about what's been described thus far, understand why he was feeling in that way. The picture in the first 12 verses of Exodus 6 is that we have here a great man of God who's got some issues. He's got some big issues at this time in his life. Perhaps if we had a psychologist here tonight that we could give him this information and ask him to make an assessment, he would say that at this time in his life, Moses had some self-esteem problems. Maybe a psychologist would say that Moses was struggling with the image of self-worth. It certainly seems, as we look at these verses, verse 12 in particular, that at this time he had something like a defeatist attitude. Israel was still in bondage. Moses had not delivered them. Things had only gotten worse. And maybe because of this uncircumcised lips expression, maybe Moses was looking at something in his life, some moral failing. And as he was perhaps reflecting on something that he had done or had not done, maybe he thought, the people are still here in Egypt because of me. God, I was appointed as a deliverer, and because of something in my life, something is amiss, and the program is not working out very well. What a heavy burden to struggle with. Moses was discouraged. Here's a man who was dispirited. As we look at Exodus 6, we find that God's greatest servants, in the past and now, can struggle with things like discouragement, despair, feelings of being downtrodden, dispirited. As Moses may have been in what seems to be a depressed state, God spoke. Notice the next verse, which I'm not going to read. Verse 13 in Exodus 6 says that Moses and Aaron, they were given a charge by God. And it's not a difficult charge. God simply says to Moses, you need to get up. You need to arise. This man was not going to be allowed to sit around and feel sorry for himself. Moses didn't have all the answers that he wanted at this point, but God said to this man, you need to get moving. If Moses had started a personal pity party, God said, the party's over. I'm not going to let you sit and wallow in this set of circumstances. What God did with Moses is still good and often practical and needed advice for people today. Teresa and I know a woman, and I didn't talk to Teresa about this, but she could name her, I think, as well as I can. Teresa and I know a woman who's not associated with this congregation, but is a Christian. And she often struggles with major depression. We've known this lady for a long time, and there have been periods in her life where all she wants to do is sleep. Finds it very, very difficult to get out of bed. Now, I'm not a doctor of the mind. I'm not a psychologist or anything else. This starts with the letter P as far as a doctor of the mind. And I do believe that there are cases where people can profit, where they do need some prescriptions. But also, as we look at the Bible, as we look at life, as we listen to people who are doctors of the minds, allowing the body to basically shut down and be idle, that is not a good thing. There are some significant consequences when that kind of thing begins to occur. People can go through times in life where, because of the circumstances, they are tempted to withdraw. They just begin to shut down little by little. And they can withdraw, they can shut down to the point where it is almost impossible for someone, a loved one, someone who cares about them, to reach them. Sometimes it happens, not because a person has died, but sometimes it happens because of a job loss. Sometimes it happens because a person receives news about a serious health issue. And because of that, they become focused on that, they become overly concerned about that, and that's the only thing that they think about. And eventually discouragement sets in to the point where they find it very, very difficult to get out of bed and to get moving. As we look at Exodus 6, there's a message here. If we get to that point in our life for whatever reason at some time, God's message to us will still be, get moving. May not be easy. We may not want to move very far or move very fast, but God says you need to get up and you need to get going. Now, this is not, if we had this just one time, this would be enough. But this is by no means the only time that we have someone who's depressed, someone who's discouraged, and God says, you need to get up. You need to start moving. The pity party is over. You may remember the story of Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19. Elijah is dispirited at this point. There are people that want to kill him, so he goes off to a cave. Well, people generally don't go off to a cave to have a party. People will go to a cave to be a recluse. They'll go to a cave to withdraw and be separate from folks, or in some situations, hide. Elijah was so dispirited that in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 4 says, he said to God, basically, take my life. Things are so bad, things are so rotten, God, I want to die. Then in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 9, as we navigate through the story, this verse comes right out and has God asking Elijah, hey, Elijah, what are you doing? And then in verse 11 of 1 Kings chapter 19, God says to this prophet essentially the same thing that he told him Moses in Exodus chapter 6. God says to his prophet, get up, get moving. You need to go forth, and you need to go forth and stand. As difficult as it may seem, getting up, starting to move, is an approved technique for overcoming problems. This is one of the lessons that we see from Exodus chapter 6. If we were to continue to read as we look at the balance of this chapter, we would find that there is a long list of names, a huge list of names. It takes us for pretty much the rest of the chapter. A few verses that don't have names, but the majority of the remaining verses do have names. And these names are ancestors of the Hebrew tribes of the people. And as I think about this part of Exodus chapter 6, I see another point related to the times when people go through periods of great discouragement. If we are a member of the body of Christ, there are some people who can help us. There are some people who can assist us during these times. Now, this is not the primary mission of the church, but it is an authorized activity of the church. Moses had some people. He had some ancestors, and they sort of needed to get on board with God's plan, but he did have some people who were of the same faith, who were headed in the same direction, and people who should have ultimately been encouraging to him. Not long ago, I had the chance to speak to a young man. I suspect that he's about 16 or 17, and he's currently involved in a local Boy Scout troop. I finished with my scouting before this fellow was born, but as we began to sit down and talk about some of the things related to Boy Scouting, it became clear that even though we were from two different eras as far as scouting is concerned, there have been some things that have been changed a little bit, but as we compared notes, we began to realize rather quickly that we had many of the same experiences, even though we were separated by at least a generation. What I'm describing is not something that's limited to scouting. Motherhood. If you see women that have had a child and they get together with other women, they have a bond. There is something there that connects them together. Now, the experience probably wasn't quite identical. You know, this one may have been in this kind of hospital. Another person may have gone through the experience at home. There are some differences, but still, for the sake of the point, there are enough points of commonality that people are brought together. There is common ground. The military. If you talk to people, if you've served in the military and you meet up with another person who's served in the military, instantly, there are some things that each one has in common. They can identify with the technical training, they can identify with the boot camp, they can identify with the military chain of command, and all of those things. Basic college, as well as graduate school, if people have gone through these experiences, once again, it may have been a different school, it may have been a different degree program, it may have been a different subject, but these things bind people together. Well, in the church that Christ built, the church was constructed in such a way where people are bound together once they become a member of it. Paul made this clear in Romans chapter 6, verse 17, when he says, you have obeyed the form of teaching. In other words, he says, there is this form, there is this system, there is this pattern of teaching. If you are a Christian, Paul says, you went through this program. Now, somebody may have been baptized in a bathtub, somebody else may have been baptized at a church building, somebody else may have been baptized in a farmer's pond. Place may have differed. The circumstances, the time may have been different, but still we have that same basic experience as far as conversion. Now, in the religious world, people don't have that experience. One person says, well, I was saved by the sinner's prayer. Another says he accepted Jesus into his heart. Another person says, I put my hand on the television set as the preacher was praying. But if we've gone through the experience that the New Testament describes to become a Christian, we then have some points that bind us together with other people. Just as God's people in Egypt had some things in common, and that commonality should have been an encouraging thing for Moses. It should have given him some people that could have shared his burdens. Such is also true for the New Testament church. Galatians 6:2 says, bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. Why give that command? Paul was able to give that command because we share so many points of commonality when it comes to Christianity. The point is made elsewhere in the New Testament by describing the New Testament church as a family. Family can often understand and sympathize with what other family members are dealing with. So the church, for this reason and others, is compared to a family. We read about the household of God. We also find words like brother and sister, mother, father, words which say that we are a single group. And when we have times of discouragement, when there are times perhaps that a member of the church does not want to get out of bed because he or she is so discouraged, there are some folks that are on the same road. They've gone through some of the same experiences. They're headed to the same place. And they can understand and they can help. In Romans 15, verse 1, Paul said, we that are strong, and it's a principle here rather than actually a direct application of the point that we're making. He said, we that are strong need to bear the iniquities of the weak. And then, more specifically, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14, Paul said to a different group of people, you've got some faint-hearted members, some people who are about ready to quit, some people who are really discouraged. And Paul says, you encourage those people. How can you do that? Well, in part because we've got some things that are points of commonality. And then he says at the end of that verse, you also support the weak. There are people today who have the same spiritual desires that we do. The struggles that we have as individual Christians are also faced by fellow saints. The people around us, fellow Christians, they are in some respects one of God's gifts to us to help us get through some of the difficult times in life. Now, there were some people in Moses' day who surely could have comforted him to help eliminate that discouragement that he faced, and such is also true for our day and time. If you ever talk to someone who seeks out counseling, and I'm thinking really of a counselor in the secular realm, you will generally find a person saying something like this. We want to find a counselor that we're comfortable with. We want to find a helper that can sympathize with me. We want to talk to someone who can be sympathetic. Well, there are times where it's good to find someone who has some specialized skills in the area of counseling. But I'd like to suggest that when we think about someone that can sympathize and empathize and really understand where we're coming from, it's a member of the church. They may not have the degrees on the wall. They may not have gone to school as much as a secular counselor has as far as helping folks. But through the church, God gives us several people that we can receive help from. Now, I'm not affirming that every person in the church may be the ideal helper for us. There may be some Christians who are too young in the faith. If we're dealing with a thing that relates to motherhood, a man may not be the best individual to talk to in that set of circumstances. But if a congregation has at least 30 or 40 people, and we have that number here, they should be able to find some folks who can aid them as they go through times of great discouragement. All too often, people, and sadly this is even sometimes true for Christians, they suffer. And they suffer in silence, feeling like there is nobody around to help them. Maybe that's a little bit what Moses did. Elijah did that. And yet, even in the case of Elijah, Romans chapter 11, God came to this prophet and said, I have yet 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. There are always some people that can help. If we're a Christian, we should be able to find help among fellow saints, as well as offer help to our brethren. All right, two keys. In Exodus chapter 6, as far as getting through some of the difficult times in life, let's look at a third key. And this is found in the idea of someone who truly tries to turn to God. Moses, at this point in his life, he could have been thinking, well, I tried the God thing. God appeared to me in the burning bush, and I've gotten to the point now where I'm actually in Egypt. And I've tried God for a little while. But let's see how well that's working out for me. I'm discouraged. The Hebrew people are still in Egypt. They are burdened more than before. And this God thing, it hasn't worked out real well for me, so I'm going to turn back. I've tried God, he's failed me, and it's just not going to work out quite as I had hoped. One of man's greatest weaknesses is a failure to follow through. And this weakness is especially true in our day and time. You may have seen a situation that I have witnessed a few times over the years as a person who gets a product. Maybe it comes in the mail, or maybe a person says, well, look at this piece of junk that just arrived. And it was said to do this and this, and it doesn't work. The person who hears that information says, could I look at that? And after spending some time with it, the person who didn't originally receive the information says, well, this is the way it works. It really does work. And not only does this product really work, I mean, it works really, really well. This is a truly wonderful product. Well, what I just described is oftentimes what happens with people when it comes to God. I have had, over the years, literally people who have told me that they've tried God. And with this trial of God, and I don't mean try in the sense that you're going to try to test him and do some bad things to him or with him, but in the sense that I've explored the religious path in life for a little while, and it just didn't work out that well for me. When I hear people like that, it's almost like they're saying, I picked up this product off the TV or the internet off the shelf, and I took it home for a little bit, and I checked it out, and you know, after spending a few hours or a few days or a few weeks with it, it just wasn't what I thought it was. It's not going to meet my needs, so I'm going to return it. I'm going to reject it. Moses could have had that attitude. He could have said, well, I've tried God for a little while, and things are just not going so swell, so I'm going to toss in the towel. I'm not going to be the deliverer. I'm not going to continue to follow God. Well, God promises to help his people through difficult times. But we need to remember that his promise to help us is conditional. There's a passage in Matthew 11, which is a text that is probably one of the most familiar to us as we look at this first account of Jesus' life. It's Matthew 11, verses 28 and 29. It is here that Jesus talked about those who labor. Well, here's a person who's distressed. Here's a person who's discouraged and heavy laden. He knew that people can be heavy laden by many things, sin as well as some other items. And here's what the Lord said to those who want his help. Matthew 11, verse 28. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Now, as I see that word come in Matthew 11, verse 28, it is like a giant neon sign. It is like a huge flashing light. God says, come to me. Now, as I see these words, the question, because of tonight's material, the question that comes to my mind is, how long, Lord? God, you've said, come. How long should I come? How long should I stay? Should I be with you? Should I come long enough just to check you out? Should I engage you on some kind of trial period? Should I come, God, just long enough to get what I want and then depart? God, should I come to you for 6 months? Should I come to you for a year or maybe half my life? The command to come is expounded on in Matthew 11, verse 29. He says, take my yoke upon you and learn of me. When the Lord spoke about taking a yoke and learning from him, that does not sound like it is any kind of trial process. This sounds like this is a long commitment, or we might say a lifelong commitment. The words yoke and learn indicate that this is to be an ongoing activity. When people have an interest in God, when people have an interest in having God help them through the difficulties in life, it is, God, we need to come to you. And we're coming. And we're going to stay. We recognize, as we see in Exodus chapter 6, that things may not be resolved immediately. It may take some time to get through this. There might be, it's not going to always be a microwave process as far as just going like that. But Moses was someone who stayed the course. God knew that about him. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why God picked him. This is also true for people today. They think that God's going to bail me out. He's going to help me. Well, what are you going to do after you get the help? What if it takes a little while to get the assistance? People, when they become discouraged and dispirited and think about spiritual things, God says, you come. You put on my yoke. You learn of me. And you do this throughout your entire lifetime. Now, the devil's in the other corner. He's hoping that we're going to quit, that we're going to throw in the towel. But God says, here are my arms of fellowship. Here's the place of safety. Here's the place of self. Here's the place of refuge. You come to me. Engage me. Stay with me. And it'll be okay. As I was thinking about this part of the material, my mind went back to the Old Testament, Psalm 23. When I hear Psalm 23 referenced or read, it is almost always at a funeral. But tonight I'd like to suggest that Psalm 23 is a passage which might be better used for us or with us as we go through daily life. Let's think about how the King James translation renders this Old Testament text. The Lord is my shepherd. Well, doesn't that sound a lot like Matthew 11, verse 28? Come, take my yoke. Learn of me. Lord, you're going to be my shepherd for life. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. How long? When we're young, when we're in the middle of life, and when we're in the old part of life. He leadeth me beside still waters, even though troubles may rage in the world. He restores my soul. Then once again, that word lead. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, though there may be some times in my life which are grim, some times which are so discouraging, yea, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Why? For thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Why? Because we commit ourselves to God. We stick with him through thick and thin. And then the writer said, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. When a person becomes a Christian, if they truly understand what they're doing, they say to God, we're coming and we're not leaving. We're going to find, in addition to that commitment, comfort through your people. And then as we looked at that first lesson from Exodus chapter 6 as well, discouragement may come, but regardless of what happens, God, we're going to be with you all the way. We may not always understand it, but we've got the tools to deal with it as we go through life. What a great, great blessing. Tonight, we hope that you are someone who has made that commitment, that you have decided in your heart, in your mind, that God is the way to go. And he's not something that's going to be a trial for you. It is a commitment that you've made, and it's a commitment that you're going to keep until your dying breath. This evening, if you've been struggling with that because of some problems in your life and you thought, well, God just doesn't seem to be helping me in the way that I need to be helped, hang in there. There can be some rough times, as we see from the life of Moses. God got him through. Saw him through all kinds of difficult things, as we'll see later in future studies. But tonight, if you need your faith strengthened, if you need to renew your commitment to God, and we can help you in that way, we'd like to do those things. If you're someone who's been thinking about God, will he really work for me? The answer to the question is yes. But for that to work, you've got to come to him, be willing to learn, and be willing to accept that yoke every single day. Not a perfect life, but an obedient life. And tonight, those are the things that we'd like to consider as we stand and sing the selected song.